UK Wine Show, show number 123. Wines of the Goldtropschen. On this week's award-winning wine show, we're talking about wines from the Goldtropschen with Gernot Hahn from Kurt Hahn, Peter Leinhardt from Leinhardt Wirt, Angster Schmidt from the Mosel Wine Production. We also get down and dirty with Terroir in the spotlight.
And in the news, Gang of Five launch wine site, Twitter host virtual wine tastings, and TV programme likens wine to Alka-Pops.
G'day! Welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 123 for the 19th of September 2008. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's show we're talking with Gernot Hahn from Kurt Hahn, Peter Leinhardt from Leinhardt Wirt, Angster Schmidt from the Mosel Wine Productions, and we're talking about the wines from the Goldtropschen. In the spotlight, we cut new ground by looking at what is in the soils. When I started studying wine, people often referred to soils such as shale under loam, and I was supposed to automatically know what that meant. Well, this week we're going to have a look at what's under our feet, and hopefully start the process of understanding what the soils really mean. To lighten the mood, we're going to change the way we finish our quote from now on. So I think what we're going to do is I'm going to give you the quote and I want you to see if you can work out who said it. And I'll give you some clues as we go through the show. Nothing makes a future look so rosy as to contemplate it through a glass of Chambertin. Clues throughout the show, answer at the end. But next up, we have the news with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. A new online subscription service called The Wine Gang has just been launched by five UK wine critics, aiming to inform consumers of the best wines on offer in the UK. The five are Ollie Smith of BBC One's Saturday Kitchen, Tom Canavan of winepages.com, Anthony Rose of The Independent, Joanna Simon of The Sunday Times, and Tim Atkin MW of The Observer. Each month they'll compile a comprehensive report featuring at least 200 tasting notes and covering both good and bad wines. They'll rank each wine on a 100-point scale. They'll also pick five top fives every month, with the five greatest, the five best value, five to lay down, five shockers and five of the moment. They're offering a free trial membership available until October the 31st, and after that time annual membership will cost £19.99. If you're interested in finding out more, visit thewinegang.com.
I'm not too sure if this will take off. Certainly Tim Atkin's got a fantastic palate and I'm sure he tastes loads of wines every week. But at 20 quid a year, you can get a lot of free recommendations online. So whether people want to pay that for that, we'll see. But there's also another wine tasting service just starting up. What's that, Jane?
Well, it's slightly different and it involves social networking site Twitter. An online retailer in the United States and a French wine producer have joined up to stage monthly virtual wine tastings. Bin End Wines and Hugel & Fee have run two tastings so far, and the third will be staged on September the 18th, with wine bloggers from the UK, Spain and the United States. These bloggers will taste a selection of wines from Hugel's range and post their conversations on the Twitter site, which Twitter users can then log on to, follow and add their comments. Again, it'll be interesting to see how much interest they get, but if you do want to take part in future tastings, you can visit www.twittertastelive.com.
Cheers, Jane. Twitter is a huge phenomenon in the States, and particularly with IT people. Not too sure about how many people use it in the wine trade, but that said, if you're a slightly techie person and you subscribe to Twitter, definitely having a look. The last story this week was about that dispatcher's show on Channel 4, Jane. What's going on there?
Well, this TV programme claimed this week that some wines are little better than Alka-Pops by revealing that some wine producers use additives to enhance the flavour of wine and that they fail to list all of the ingredients on the label. That's no surprise to people in the wine industry, but maybe to the general public. The What's in Your Wine programme featured wine experts such as Jancis Robinson, who after tasting 18 on-vintage champagnes, rated only 30 as good value for money. Drinks industry bodies have hit back already, with Jeremy Beadles, chief exec of the Wine and Spirit Trade Association, defending the strict regulations that exist to oversee the winemaking process and ensure products meet stringent health and safety standards. He also argued that the cost of labelling wine would be hugely expensive, estimated at 1 billion euros to the industry over 3 years. That's it from me this week, but don't forget you can get these stories in full at our website 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. I watched the Channel 4 documentary on Tuesday, and while there were some surprises, most of it wasn't really a surprise. For those of you not in the UK or missed the show, the argument was that wine was full of dodgy chemicals. They talked about only sulfide, sulfur dioxide, needing labelling, and not other chemicals. Common chemicals added to wine include sugar and acetic acid, but they also mentioned more dodgy sounding fining agents such as clay, egg whites, fish eggs, etc. The general response painted by the show from the trade appeared to be that labelling would detract wine drinkers. The response was very weak from the Wine Spirit Trade Association, and I think it's because most people don't realise what's used in winemaking processes. I know what's allowed to go into wine, and I'm comfortable with that, but if you're not really into wine, the idea of maybe putting egg whites into your wine is a bit of off-putting. Sure, there's very little egg white in the final wine because it's a fining agent and comes out of the wine, but people in the public don't know that. The show got stuck into Italian producers who seem to be adding sugar and water to their wines to make the wines go a bit further. Not a good thing from a quality point of view, I'm sure. But to mask the sugar, which is illegal, they appear to be adding other chemicals such as hydrochloric acid and sulfuric acid. This is shocking and appalling, and seriously, those producers need to get a rocket up them. They touched on all the recent scandals in Italy about which grapes are being used in wines such as Vino Nobile di Montepulciano. And again, the Italians, they certainly can't hold their head up in pride. But it wasn't just the Italians who had a fear going over. France got a good old kicking. Champagne in particular was up for it after decades of dumping rubbish on their vineyards, which they did initially to get organic matter back into the soils. But as waste changed, and particularly plastic bags came in the 1970s, as well as glass and electronics, the waste that they were putting on their vineyards started to poison the soil. Now, it is public knowledge. I remember writing an essay on the mess Champagnes have got themselves into with regards to their soils 5 years ago. Heavy metals, toxins, are a risk to Champagne. And to be honest, putting them on your vineyards is just sloppy. I suppose being positioned as an ultra-premium product, this should not be the case. Jancis Robinson, MW, and wine writer and all-round wine expert, made some comments on the show as well after tasting 80 champagnes blind that only 30 were value for money, with big brands such as Moët, Veuve Clicquot in the bottom 30, and Piper Heidsieck, the second worst wine she tasted, it's a bit of a worry about whether the brands are good value. Let's not muck around here. There are some fantastic champagnes out there that represent good value from £15 all the way to £200. But there's a lot of fizz out there that other countries can match and beat and do it a lot cheaper. But France was also hammered about what's in their wines when they uncovered that only 3% of agricultural land in France is under vine, but the French vineyards use 15% of the pesticides used in agricultural land. France and Italy did get singled out in the show, and you can see why. Both of them vie for producing the most wine each year, and they've got an industry made up of small producers. That sort of size and lots of small producers mean that any documentary can find a couple of rotten eggs. But adding water to your wine, sugar, and then acidity to hide it, I think these Italian producers should have been banned. I do think apart from adding the odd bit of sugar, the scandal there wasn't that much in the show. I don't mind a good description on the back of the wine labels. And if they include fining agents, so be it. People won't be turned off. They don't get turned off by E220 on the back of the bottle. That's sulfur dioxide, if you're not sure. And I can't see why a couple more E numbers on the back won't get in the way. I don't think you need to write egg whites. You just use an E number reference and people can look that up if they really want to. There was an argument that managing what goes into each barrel is too hard. But I say that's rubbish. What sort of winemaker are you if you don't record your processes? Producing labels can be costly, especially for small producers making lots of small production runs. And I can see the issue. In the end, labeling will not hurt producers. It's just a load of red tape to add on to the process. Perhaps the winners are vegetarians who could drink so much wine out there, if only they knew they could. It's poor labelling on the back of wine bottles that stops them from doing that. So, in summary, I thought the Dispatches was biased. It did find a couple of bad eggs, but there was some truth there. The wine trade seems to have got quite uppity about it all, but I think they need to look at themselves a bit harder and think, why is wine allowed not to write what goes into the bottle on the back of the label? I don't think there should be an exemption. Well, that was a bit of a rant. How are you going with the quote? I've got another clue for you. Remember, the quote is, nothing makes a future look so rosy as to contemplate it through a glass of Chamburton. Well, what's the clue? Well, what is Chamburton? Chamburton is a Grand Cru vineyard located in the village of Gevrey-Chamburton in the Côte d'Ivoire district of Burgundy. It's only allowed to grow Pinot Noir. Hope that helps. Next up, we have the Spotlight. Now, Jane pointed out last week's Spotlight we'd already covered, so if you're sitting there going, I've heard this before, it's probably because you have. I wanted to start out at the beginning of our journey and recap what we knew. This week, we're going to get down and dirty in the ground. We discover what is in the vineyards. And to be honest, people have always assumed when they're talking about soils that I know what they're talking about. Well, this week, we try and give a high-level view of soils and rocks. It is a bit geeky. And Jane, after reading the transcript and when we put it on the website, said, who would want to read this? Well, me. So hopefully you too. So let's get down and dirty in the dirt. At the surface, soil is made up of a loose covering of broken rock particles enriched with decomposing organic matter. Soils are often defined by the size of the mineral grains, a mineral being a solid substance that has a crystalline structure. Minerals range in composition from pure elements, simple salts, to very complex silicates with thousands of known forms. The size of the minerals determine this type of soil. The smallest particle size is called clay and is usually defined as less than 2 micrometers in diameter. Silt is the next size, up usually 2 to 50 micrometers, and then you start getting into fine sand around 50 micrometers and up to 200 micrometers, it's starting to be called coarse sand. As the size continues to increase, eventually it reaches the size of gravel. A mixture of the three, called loam, is quite common in vineyards, and it's made up of around 40% sand, 40% silt, and 20% clay. Loam is considered a perfect base for great soils because it can hold nutrients and organic matter well. The organic matter is often referred to as humus, and is responsible for the dark brown, black colour of soil. Humus is the stale remains of decayed plant and animal matter. While not well understood, it is thought to be an important part of the fertility of the soils, both physically and chemically. Physically, it helps maintain the moisture and the spongy structure. Chemically, the humus helps the plant access nutrients by providing ions that bind to those nutrients, making them more easily accessible to plants. Humus is most common in topsoil. Now, topsoil is the top layer of the soil, obviously, usually between 5 centimeters and a meter deep. 2 to 24 inches deep. It contains the most organic matter and is the most biologically active part of the soil. It also is where plants concentrate their roots and obtain the most nutrients. While it may not look as if topsoil is changing, it is wrong to think of it as an inert. Weather and biological processes change it over the centuries. Penetrated by living and then dying roots, plants, bacteria, animal life, fungi, molds, insects, and worms all burrow, break up, and mix up the soil, enriching it and making it more porous. Below the topsoil, it merges with minerals to create subsoil. Subsoils often contain clay or loess, which is windblown sediment. Nutrients are available to plants, but they need to be changed first into a more usable form. Below the subsoil, we have the underlying rock. Now, there are three types of rocks, as we said last week: sedimentary, igneous, and metamorphic. Sedimentary rocks are formed by layers of small particles forming into a solid matter over time. The three common are sandstone, limestone, and shale. Sandstone is a coarse-grained sedimentary rock comprised mainly of sand-sized minerals or rock grains. Most sandstone is composed of quartz or rock-forming minerals. Porosity is high enough for sandstone to sometimes form aquifers. Limestone is a sedimentary rock comprised largely of calcium carbonate, mainly formed by marine organisms. It may also include clay, silt, sand, and also silica. Porosity and permeability are both high. Shale is the last of the sedimentary rocks, and it's fine-grained, whose original constituents were clay, minerals, or muds. It's characterized by thin laminae breaking with an irregular curvature, often splintery. Shale is the most common type of sedimentary rock. The second types of rocks you're going to get is igneous rocks. These are formed from volcanic eruptions. Rocks that are formed by the fast-cooling magma create basalt and rhyolite, while slow-cooling forms other types of rocks, such as granite. Basalt forms when lava flows. It's usually grey or black and fine-grained due to the rapid cooling at the Earth's surface. It may contain crystals or have many fine holes caused by bubbles when the rock cools. Rhyolite is formed from cooling of lava at the Earth's surface. Its composition is made up of at least 69% silicon. Granite is a common occurring rock that forms when it cools while under the surface. It has a medium to coarse texture, occasionally with larger crystals. The colours range from pink and grey to black. Granite does not have an internal structure such as layers, and it has a very low porosity of less than 0.01. We'll get onto porosity in a bit more detail later on. Metamorphic rocks are those that are heated up and are subject to high pressure from being buried deep within the earth. The heated rocks create hornfields, granulite, while high temperatures and high pressures create slate and schist. Hornfields is a series of rocks that have been baked and recrystallized by the heat of the molten igneous rocks. They can form striking stripes of different fine-grained rocks, such as sandstone, shale, slate, and limestone. They are hard, splintery, and in some cases exceedingly tough and durable. Granulite is a medium-grain metamorphic rock that experienced high temperatures. Composed mainly of crystallized minerals, quartz, and slate, granulite does not have an internal structure, i.e. no layers. The last metamorphic rock is schist. Now, it's a medium-grade metamorphic rock forming from rocks that were sedimentary or igneous. The key character is that they have a fine alternating layers of different minerals and minerals such as micas, chlorite, talc, hornblende, graphite, and others. Quartz often occurs in drawn-out grains to such an extent a particular form called quartz schist is produced. By definition, schist must contain at least 50% of platy and elongated minerals, often finely layered with quartz and mineral rocks. Well, that ends this week's Look at Spotlight. I know some of you have probably gone, how boring was that? And I hope it wasn't too bad. I think I'm a bit of a sad bunny because I really enjoy this geology stuff. I know it's a bit geeky, but it's something people talk about with wine, but no one ever explains. So hopefully we're getting there, and more to come in the following weeks. Now, another clue from the quote. Remember the quote? Nothing makes the future look so rosy as to contemplate it through a glass of Chamberton. Well, here's a clue. The person did more to influence the current shape of Burgundy than Phylloxera did 50 years after his death. Next up, we're over to the Goldtropschen, talking about the wines from Goldtropschen, with Gernot Hard from Kurt Hahn, Peter Lennart from Lennart Wirt, and Angster Schmitz from the Mosel Wine Production. Let's have a listen to what they have to say. Hi, I'm here with Gernot Hind from Kurt Hahn. How are you, Gernot?
Hi, Chris.
We've got Peter Lennart from Lennart Wirt.
Hi, Chris.
And I've also got Angster Schmitz from the Mosel Wine Production.
How are you, Chris? Fine.
Yeah, I'm good, mate. I'm good. We're in the Goldtropschen still, and we're going to be talking a wee bit about the wines from here. We've just had a bit of a tasting. I've tasted a reasonable number of the wines. And one of the things I've noticed is normally with German wines and German Rieslings, I normally expect the wines to be mainly sort of green apples, maybe lemons, limes if I'm lucky, but really quite austere. And one of the things about your wines is the ripeness of the flavors, really mangoes, pineapples sort of thing. Is that typical or is it just the vintages we've been having?
Yeah, it's typical for Peaceport because Peaceport has a special climate for the Mosel. The vineyard side is open to south and we have a deep soil, enough water. That means in warm and dry years we have enough water for the grape, for the wines.
Yep.
And they can produce sugar and minerals the whole summer.
But they're awfully ripe. They smell awfully ripe. Obviously, how sweet they are is dependent on the winemaking.
Very rich wines. It's typical for peace porters.
Yeah, okay. Yes. Is that all the way up and down the Mosel? Is that common or is it more peace port?
I think it's peace port. It's typical for peace port when you have very exotic fruit and rich wines. And often they have a lot of minerals and they need time. They're not too early ripe. Mm-hmm. They need a few months to get develop to a nice taste, and that's why they have a lot of things in it.
Sure. I've noticed aniseed in the wines as well. Is that common?
Some type of this aromas sometimes, but it's not very common. Usually you have the fruit aromas, sometimes you have some herb aromas, that's spicy aromas you find from time to time, but it depends on vintages as well. So you might have big differences between vintages, between vineyard sites as well, depending on soil and microclimate, on the work of the wine growers naturally as well.
There seems to be the Golden Tropfen is quite a small area. I think it's,
160 acres today.
Okay, so it's quite small, but there's a huge range of wines coming out of there. You've got dry through to sweet. What sort of styles of wines can you make in the Golden Tropfen?
Yeah, there are a lot of styles you can make. It's a difference to other wine areas. I think we have a selective harvest. We harvest early and later, sometimes very late, and so we get different kind of grapes, and some are good for the cabinets, some are riper and Spätlese, and the others are the Auslese, and for Auslese we do a selection, and then there are some wines that are a little bit sweeter, and the other one are very sweet, and we have also some dry and fine herb wine, because we have customers which want these wines, not only the sweet wines, also the drier wines.
So to me, trying to get my head around it, you've got a set of rules that sort of govern the almost like the must weight or the sugar at picking, isn't it? So that's your cabinets, your Spätlesers, your Auslesers, your Trockenbaren Auslesers. And then depending on what the winemaker does in terms of how much they ferment the wine and to dryness and how much sugar they leave in it, then you've got another set of things. Is that right?
That's right.
And what are the sweetness or dryness levels that you can choose in a wine?
According to the German wine law, we have wines with up to 9 grams of residual sugar, which are called trocken, that means dry. And then above that, we have the level up to 18 grams residual sugar per liter. That's what we call halbtrocken, or today it's called feinherb. It means medium dry or off dry. And above that, it's the sweet level. First, we call it lieblich, which means mellow. And above 50 grams of sugar, about 50 grams of sugar, we usually call it sweet. And that goes up to more than 200 grams of sugar per liter. But these are very rare and special wines, which are the Trockenbären Auslese, for example, or Bären Auslese. So you pick or select the noble grains out of the grapes and only use them for the must, and the amount you get is very, very low. And these wines are very sweet, but they can keep for decades, even for 50 or 100 years, depending on storing conditions.
I tasted some wines with Kernot last night. And we tried your, was it a Spätlese or an Auslese?
Spätlese from 94.
And it was quite, technically it was supposed to be quite sweet, but it was actually really dry.
Yes.
It seemed to be almost as the wine aged, it lost sugar. Is that true, or was I just tasting things that seemed wrong?
No, the sugar analytic is the same than 14 years ago, but develops to, it's more in the background now, the sugar. And you taste it not so sweet than 40 years ago. And it's nearly dry, you say.
Yeah, well, it tasted dry, but you're saying there's still loads of sugar in the wine. You just don't notice the sugar.
Yes.
That just seems counterintuitive to me.
Yeah.
The only way I can think of it is maybe a bit like maybe tannins.
Yeah, we talked about this yesterday.
Yeah.
I think it's a reason. It's true with the tannin. It's similar to the wine with tannin. When it's aged, it gets milder.
Is that why, if you get a really, really sweet dessert wine, in 50 years' time, it's nowhere near as sweet? Is that always the truth, or is
no,
that just...
The really sweet wines, like Bärenauslese and Trockenbärenauslese, I think they keep, and you can taste it because it's too much. It's 200 rest sugar, it's very, it's a lot, and you can taste it in 20 years and 30 years, and therefore they are good wines to drink in and to keep and to drink in 30 years.
One of the key things for Goldentropfen is the, people talk about it as the slate, that the soils, the slate and the soils. And that seems to give that minerality to the wine. Is it just slate that gives that sort of real, it's an edgy sort of minerality? You know, it sort of, to me, it seems to sit on top of the acidity and just sort of really make the acidity quite edgy. Is that what you guys experience?
Steely.
Steely, yeah.
Yeah. Steely. Yeah, it's a slate soil with a, you saw in the morning the quartzite. I show you the quartz.
Mm.
And we have a blue and red slate soil. Yeah, they when they are young, the 2007, a lot of wines we had steely taste, minerally, flintstone.
I found the drier styles of wines that we tasted, that minerality was almost too much. I found it, you know, quite hard to enjoy. But once you got into the richer styles, even if they were drier, you know, Spätlesers, even if they were sort of a Halbtrocken or a Trocken, they seemed to be able to take that minerality a bit better. And it
depends on the occasion you drink this wine.
With and food the, as well?
When you have fish.
Yeah.
I think the Cabernet is lighter and the minerality is nice with fish and acidity.
What sort of food do these wines, you know, if we look at, say, a Cabernet with lots of minerality versus, say, a Spätlese with a bit more sweetness, and then all the way through to a Trockenbärenauslese, what's, if I was to food match, what sort of food would I match with, say, a Cabernet?
Yeah, Cabernet dry, it's a fish, and, you know, asparagus, and the fine herb wines, Asian cuisine,
That seems to be quite popular in the UK, Asian cuisine still.
Yeah.
Alsace did a big marketing push in the UK, you know, think Asian, drink Alsace. Mm. We haven't really heard anything about, you know, German Rieslings with Asian food so much from a marketing point of view.
Mm.
But it is a wine that could go quite well with Asian foods.
My experience is that the slightly sweeter styles of our Rieslings, especially Riesling Cabernet, fine herb or slightly sweet, are matching Asian food very well. I often compare it at home and trying drier styles and sweeter styles, and the drier styles are always the loser because they don't have enough ripeness and fruit to accompany the often spicy or hot aromas, and this, sometimes the sweetness of peanut butter sauce, for example, or peanut sauce, or with other sweeter components of the food. So I usually tend to take a Cabernet fine herb or a Cabernet sweet Riesling with my Asian cuisine. I think Riesling shouldn't be too dry to go along with Asian food. I think that's a bit dangerous. In my opinion, in general, even the little bit sweeter styles, if they are ripe and if they are a few years old, they can match a big range of food, from game to chicken and fish, seafood, everything. So you find in our diversity of wine styles we have, you find nearly for every food you find a matching wine. You can match Trockenbärenauslese with blue cheese, for example. You can match an old, ripened, sweet wine, an Auslese, like, let's say, 5-6 years old. You can match it very easily with foie gras, for example. With a lot of cheese, sweeter white wines, in my opinion, are matching far better than red wine, for example, because the red wines tend to become astringent with the sweet, with the cheese.
I interviewed a guy a wee while ago from Wines for Spice, and he makes wines to go with Asian cuisine. And he seemed to think a a bit of residual sugar, just a bit of sweetness in there, takes the heat out of chili foods and all that sort of stuff. So that's quite nice. Just moving on a wee bit to where these wines are sold, what's your biggest market?
Our biggest market is Germany. And then the next biggest market, or the biggest export market we have, is the United States. After that, where there's Netherlands and Great Britain, Norway, Japan, Belgium, Canada. So most of the wines are sold to everywhere in the world, even to Brazil or China. Eastern Europe is coming quite good along, Russia, for example. But Germany is still the biggest market.
Are you worried about the fall of the US dollar? Because euro is getting very strong against the US dollar. So your wines must be getting more expensive to US consumers. Do you want to comment on that, Gernot?
Yes, it's a problem for us here, because you tell them it's a dollar. The wines are too expensive at the moment in the United States. And therefore, the good development of the last years is now a little bit, it's not so good at the moment.
It's been eroded away, market share that you've taken. Okay. What about the UK market? I go to my supplier. I went to a range of suppliers to get some German wines. I thought, right, let's give German wines a whirl. And I went to my suppliers and got some samples. And the wines were good. You know, they were fine, nice wines. But they were all on the sweeter side. And to be honest, when I showed them to the UK consumer, a lot of them didn't like them that much. They just found them not to their liking. But I've been here and I've tasted some lovely wines. How come I don't see them in the drier styles of German wines in the UK?
Yeah, I have an English importer, and I asked him 5 years ago. He has always a sweet Cabernet and sweet Spätlese, and sometimes Auslese or a few bottles of Bärenauslese. And I've been there, and I asked if he want to have some drier style from the Riesling. And he said, no, it's for me, it's too much education for my customers. They don't understand the German wine when there's a dry Riesling. And he don't want to have that. It's too much work for him.
Yes, that's the weirdest thing, because we taste a lot of New Zealand and Australia, well, particularly New Zealand, being a Kiwi, a lot of dry Rieslings from New Zealand, and the consumer likes them. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not that they don't like them. Do you think it's a case that the people who maybe buy German wines in England are more traditional and they know what they want, whereas...
Maybe I think our language is a bit of a problem. Complicated vineyard names like, for example, Goldtröpfchen are hard to pronounce or to read for people who speak English, and labels from Australia or from New Zealand, which are in English, are far easier to understand. So probably UK customers feel more at home with these wines, a nearer connection to them than to German wines. And I think we still suffer from the sweet and cheap image in the UK. And my experience with British friends of mine is that they usually tell us when we bring a good, nice, dry wine along when we visit them, they say, oh, you keep that nice stuff all for yourself. You can't find it here. And it's certainly true that the Germans are favoring drier and styles of Riesling too. And so our producers sell these wines at first here in Germany. And in export, traditionally, sweeter wines are exported.
But it's not that you don't want to export the wines, it's just they don't want to take them.
But I think one reason is that the importer can buy a lot of dry wine in the whole world, from Australia, from South Africa, from Italy, from France. I mean, it's now white wine. But the sweet wine, mostly he can get in Germany, and the best sweet wine, is from the Mosel. And therefore, he decide to take the sweet portfolio from the Mosel or from Germany.
Yeah, see, I know you can...
There's no place for a dry.
Yeah, but even things like your Golden Tropchen wines, with those really ripe flavours of pineapple and mangoes, etc., you don't get them from the New World. You get more limey sort of flavours coming through. And there's nothing wrong with them, they're quite nice. But I think the more riper, richer style, still with that nice sort of mineral acidity, I think it's a fantastic wine. I'm surprised that they don't break your arm to get at them.
Maybe one reason is that on the one hand, That's our percentage of Trier wines here we produce is only about 30% of the whole production, and 70% is sweet. And because the German market is demanding so much of the Trier wines, there's not so much left to export. Then there's the old idea of German wines are sweet all over the world. So that's maybe both things are coming together. And we will have to work on our image as a region which can produce very nice dry wines as well. That's even in Germany, many people don't know that. So how can I expect from somebody in UK or US or Norway or wherever that we produce drier styles of wine as well? It's I think there are many reasons coming together. And I think our producers would be glad to export more drier style wines to the UK, to the US, and probably in time that will change.
I hope it does, because I quite like them. And the pricing seems quite good. I know we're talking euros here, but what would a Spätlese, you know, a Trocken or a Halbtrocken Spätlese cost if I was to buy it in Germany?
Oh, I think the Spätlese from 7, 8 euro to 12, 15 euro.
Yeah, seven to 15 euros, depending on where they're from and all that. You see, that's quite good pricing, I think.
Yeah.
I find it quite funny that you're not selling it left, right and centre into the UK. All the wines I've been tasting, I don't have a sweet tooth, so I'm not really into sweet wines in a big way. So I've really been focusing on the drier styles of wine, and I really like them. I find it a bit disappointing that when I went looking for German wines, I couldn't get these style of wines. Where to for you guys in the future?
I think the becoming winemakers, they will make a modern style of Riesling wines like you tasted some today.
Yeah, I think the potential of the Mosel in general is that our young winemakers, where we are lucky to have a lot of young women and young men who decide to become a winemaker, who take over the businesses of their parents, they have clear focus what they want. They want high quality from steep slopes. They want the unique character of the Riesling of the Mosel. They want to show that they can make wines you can make nowhere else in the world. And many of them are more into the drier style wines because a lot of them traveled around the world, worked in New Zealand or Austria or Australia, South Africa or California, or France or wherever, or other German regions, and they know these styles from there. They know their vineyards and they know the potential and they know that they can make great wines here. Low yields, high quality, that's their what they believe in. And I think we will have a lot to come in future in terms of quality. And so I'm looking positively into the future for the Mosel.
I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that interview. I think you can tell I really like some of the wines. And I certainly had not tasted that style of some of the drier wines with ripe mango flavors before. Next week, we're off to East Germany. We're going to be talking with the first East German wine to be eligible for the VDP, and that will finish our look at Germany. We talk about their wines and what it's like for winemakers behind the Iron Curtain. But to finish up with this week, let's find out who said the quote. Nothing makes a future look so rosy as to contemplate it through a glass of Chambertin. Because it's a glass of Chambertin, it's obviously a Frenchman, often thought to have a terrible itch. Any ideas? Born in Corsica and trained as a military officer, we're talking about Napoleon. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.